I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. I would guess that Daniel Jones has learned a lot about relationships as the editor of the hugely popular New York Times Modern Love series. For more than a decade, he's read thousands of personal essays about what keeps couples together and what drives them apart. He chooses one a week for the paper's style selection section, and he selects essays for the Modern Love podcast on WBUR. Well, love is in the air, and we asked him to join us. His most recent book is Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subject with the help of 50,000 strangers. Daniel Jones, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here.
So I'm sure you get asked this all the time. You've been doing this job for more than a decade. Has this job made you a better husband and father?
I can only answer this question if my wife isn't in the room, because she just rolls her eyes when when she hears me talking in any sort of authoritative way about relationships. But
you have to learn some things over the years.
Yeah, and I mostly learn what people do. I've become less. Over the years, I've become less eager to give advice to people. I feel like the more you know, the less you say, in a way. But I feel like I've learned the patterns of how people behave and what frustrates them the most, how technology has, changed the way we communicate about love and the way we find it. Just how our expectations, what shapes our expectations and how dangerous those expectations are damaging, I guess, those expectations can be.
Sure, and I want to pick up on all of that. Are you, that could fill the full hour here.
Exactly.
But no, that's terrific. But are you, does it ever, and maybe after all these years, do things shock you or surprise you that people will send into you, as they say, a perfect stranger, telling you something about themselves or their relationship?
I guess what I'm not really shocked or surprised by the content of what people are dealing with, but I'm sometimes shocked by how clueless people can be about their own behavior.
Really?
And about how how egocentric people can be and not really how they can often think that their problem in a relationship is always caused by the other person, and how common that feeling is. I guess it's just, it makes you feel better about yourself to think that it's the other person's fault.
Do you ever feel like giving advice to that person? Like maybe you should think about this, your effect on this person?
Yeah, but I don't. I just turn down the essay and move on to the next one.
Well, let me read just a line or two from the essay that was in Sunday's Times. This is by a woman named Laura Pritchett. And sort of took my breath away, I have to say, reading this. But she begins by saying, "My marriage had long ago turned into the cliche of roommateness, and that it could suffer such a change without any emotional upheaval was revealing. In fact, the silence said it all." And in this essay, she's almost jealous of couples that would fight with each other because she and her husband, or I guess then husband, had this kind of silence about their relationship and about what went on in their relationship.
Exactly. And this is one of the patterns that I've seen. People have an idea of what love looks like. And for some people, what love looks like is peace and tranquility and getting along, being each other's best friend, being each other's best lover. There's this whole laundry list of what we bring to relationships and what our expectations of marriage, are. And but I've seen this over and over, this idea that fighting is damaging, that disagreeing is damaging, that fighting in front of your children is damaging. And I'm sure there's truth to all those things, and that's why people are so scared of it. But then people can sometimes get, as Laura did, get pushed to the other end of the spectrum where you withhold all of that and you keep it all in and you don't talk about what your needs are. And you're afraid that a fight will lead to this great unraveling, of the relationship. So you don't do it. And that kind of silence can, you know, in what I've seen, can be more damaging than having the occasional fight. You know, just have it out to say what you need and have the other person say what they need and fight about it and then cool off and then get back together. Yeah. But you got to have that push and pull. There was a wonderful essay that we ran a bunch of years ago by a Columbia physician that was similar in theme to this. And he talked about that he used to think of love. He realized that in the past he thought of love as sort of like this fragile vase, and that you had to treat with care and not break it. And he realized that love is more like a basketball that has to be this sort of rough and tumble thing that can take a lot and bounce back.
Well, even going back to her essay, and she goes on in more detail about this, the sort of quiet in her marriage. But it's what I sort of took away from it was her talking about her marriage or her relationship, that it was not worth fighting about or not worth fighting for.
Well, I think that's what disappointed her, and it disappointed her equally in herself as well as her husband. It was the dynamic that they shared, that even at the point where, after 20 years and children, that she would say, I don't remember what her words were, but, you know, we need to break up in a way. Yeah. We need to get divorced, and that huge life-changing statement, even that would not stir passions between them enough to have it out, you know? And that's what, when she says that, you know, the silence was really telling,
yeah.
That's what she found. And now she's with someone who, with whom she does share that kind of rough and tumble relationship where they do fight, they do talk, they are more open, and she finds that healthier.
In fact, when she says, I'm looking at the essay here, she tells her husband, you know, basically, I want out. What he says back to her is, are you sure? Which mm-hmm. is so interesting. As I was reading this, I was wondering, how does Laura Pritchett's previous husband feel about this essay?
Well, he read it prior to publication, and he gave his input to her, and we accommodated that. In fact, all those changes were good changes. So in situations like that, the other person is part of the process.
And I'm curious. I mean, there is something fascinating, of course, and something kind of voyeuristic as well. As we read about other people's struggles in their relationships, sometimes it's with a spouse or a mate or a partner. Sometimes it's with children. Do you think that there is a kind of voyeurism, and not a bad voyeurism, but just that we're intensely curious about how other people try to do this thing?
Yeah, I think that's why this column is successful to the extent that it is. There's an interesting kind of tension in having someone talk about something incredibly private and that makes them seem incredibly vulnerable in a forum that's potentially read by millions of people.
Right.
And you feel like as the reader that you're getting this almost a one-on-one coffee shop discussion over someone's you know, problems and what they're struggling with. And I think that's the power of that kind of narrative. But I think that's how we learn to live our lives. You know, that's how we learn to navigate our relationships, is by hearing how other people are doing it, which is a bit of my gripe with the advice world, that, you know, people are so eager to tell you how to do it. But I don't think that's really how we learn. I think we learn better by seeing how people do it and seeing someone be honest about what their weaknesses and vulnerabilities and strengths are, and learning from that this column has a big audience among college students and people in their 20s. And I've heard from a lot of them who say, you know, now the column's been running almost 12 years, who say, I've grown up according to this column. I measure my relationships, you know, I use the column, I guess, different columns as touchstones for situations that I've found myself in. And I feel like I can see them in a, you know, more intelligent way, I guess, by seeing how someone has mined their own experience and put it out there. And so someone who was, you know, 16 when they started reading it and is now 28, they use it in a touchstone in that way. It's really gratifying to me to hear that.
I bet. And those are such formative years. Speaking of advice columnists, I mean, I don't think anyone ever takes advice. I mean, obviously, it depends how it's given, but I think we have a sort of an inclination to say no when someone gives us advice anyway.
Do the other thing.
Exactly, exactly. One of the essays that I just love so much, and I reread it in preparation for the interview, it actually goes back about, 7 years or so, July 2009, Those Aren't Fighting Words, Dear. And it's about a woman whose husband wants to leave, wants to get out of the marriage, and she, in a sense, won't let him. And she doesn't believe him when he says, I don't love you. And she doesn't believe him, and she stays. And even though he's kind of cold and maybe even borderline abusive to her, not very nice to her, she hangs in there, and they do stay together. She knew he was going through a rough patch, but I thought, wow, that's really brave to say, you do love me, even when someone is saying, I don't love you.
Yeah, he said, I don't love you, and I never did.
Yeah,
that was
exactly.
That was really sticking the knife in and twisting it.
It was, but she said, I don't believe you.
Yeah, that essay really hit hard, and it was one of the most popular we've ever run in the column. It was just such a powerful statement, and she basically said, I think this is about you and not about us. And I'm prepared to wait it out. I'm just going to go ahead and live as though you didn't say that. And you can go about, figuring out what your difficulty is. And we're going to have a nice summer, and you can rejoin us if you want to. But I don't feel like this is about you not loving me, or especially about you never loving me. And she just had this sort of Zen approach. It's not to say that she found that easy.
Of course.
And she really struggled with that and had all kinds of doubts. But she just sort of called his bullshit in a way. You know, she just said, this is, you know, some people explode their relationships with statements like that because they want to explode the relationship, not because the statement is necessarily true. And she just sensed that's what he was doing. And sort of waited him out over months and months and months. I don't remember how many months that was. But that essay actually is a forthcoming episode of the podcast.
Oh, excellent.
Which will include her postscript talking about all the years and what's happened since. So I won't say any more about it. But
okay.
It'll be part of the podcast.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Daniel Jones. I should say about this essay that when she saw her husband mowing the lawn, she realized, okay, maybe he's here to stay. He is the editor of the hugely popular New York Times Modern Love series. There's a podcast now as well. And he wrote a book called Love Illuminated and joins us on Radio Times. You can join us as well to join the conversation talking about love and relationships, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you are just joining us, our guest is Daniel Jones. He's not an advice columnist, as he told us, but he has read thousands of personal essays as the editor of the New York Times' very popular series, Modern Love. It's been running almost 12 years. We were talking about one of those essays, Those Aren't Fighting Words, Dear, another one that got a lot of attention, What Shamu Taught Me About a Happy Marriage, many more as well. And we asked Daniel Jones to join us to talk about love and romance and relationships. And his most recent book is called Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. And again, you can join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So what do you look for in an essay? And you get thousands, I'm assuming thousands a week.
I get about, not quite that many. I get about 8,000 a year. So it works out to about one in every 175 or 200 that we publish. I look for, I guess, a fresh story. That's what anyone in any editor is always looking for, some sort of fresh voice and fresh perspective. More than anything, though, you want a voice that sounds honest and that sounds like they've been through something serious or dramatic and have been humbled by it. There can be a kind of show-offy kind of voice that is that a lot of people attempt where they think the writing is what really carries an essay like this. But it seems to me it's usually the perspective of someone who has been humbled by an experience and learned from it and can relay that.
Do you read them all?
I open every email. I don't. And then it's just a matter of how far into it I read. And one thing I've gotten good at this point is knowing when to stop reading and knowing what the clues are that this essay is not going to succeed. I have to say, though, that that the material that comes in is probably at a much higher quality and more appropriate for the column than most people would expect. Almost everyone who sends essays to Modern Love reads Modern Love, knows what's expected, knows what kind of story we run, and they're writing it specifically for the column. So they've figured it out, and they can trick me into reading, for more than I have time for. Actually, yeah, they trick me into reading more than I have time for. It's not until the end, often, that I end up thinking, no, this isn't quite right.
So what is Modern Love? Not the column in the paper, but when you think about Modern Love, how people love today or in our contemporary world, how has that changed? And you've been observing, pretty close up for about a dozen years.
I think the biggest single change is the volume of people who are available to us and how we then communicate with those people. Love used to be a local thing. It used to be limited to, in fact, there was a study done I wish I had the figures for it, but it was something like 50 years ago that said that that did an urban study, what it was either in New York or Philadelphia or someplace like that, that said that a really high percentage of people who wound up married were in the same within three blocks, had grown up within three blocks of each other, or even on the same block, or even within the same building. And it was some stratospheric percentage that just blew me away. And now there's sort of both the opportunity and the burden of having, just limitless people in your phone, on apps, on online dating sites. And the task has been, how am I going to narrow this down? It's like the task of me choosing an essay. How am I going to narrow this down to the one person who's right for me, who might be right? And that's an enormous change that I don't think people have quite figured out yet.
Do you think it's also part of with all those choices and how one has to define or describe oneself that you end up being very sort of picky and selective and choosy? I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but, I'm looking for a very specific kind of person that's going to fit this profile.
There's definitely that aspect. The online dating sites encourage that expectation by saying, you have to limit these numbers. So who do you think you're going to be compatible with? All the questions are aimed at that. Who do you think you're going to be compatible with? But we have a really poor record of knowing in advance who we're going to be compatible with. And that's the benefit of just running into people in the office and at school and in the neighborhood and being surprised by who we're drawn to. And meeting someone in person is a completely different experience than meeting them online. It's important what someone smells like, believe it or not. That has a lot to do with how we feel pulled toward one person or another. And you can't smell through the internet. So it puts all the power in our hands of who we're going to rule out or accept. And what I see is that most people rule in people who are like them. Oh. So if you're a Democrat, then you want to date Democrats. If you're a Republican, you want to date a Republican. If you are in finance, then you might want someone in finance. You know, it just we think that someone like us is going to be compatible, and that's a really mistaken assumption. I think we do end up with people more like us than not like us. But the way that we rule people out based on that, you know, you might be ruling out the love of your life.
Do you worry about how people find each other on the internet or are searching the internet for that perfect person, if that's who they're looking for?
I think when it turns you into a flaky person who just always is looking for something better, that can become a kind of mania, you know, where you're always looking for the next best thing. And when you're out on a date, you're thinking already of the new matches piling up in your phone. You know? And if it's not going well or there's a boring moment, you know, well, there's going to be 12 more matches by the time I get home. I think that's a problem. But, you know, the sociologist Helen Fisher talks about online dating sites as being meeting services, online meeting services. And what you need to do is get off of the online part of that as quickly as possible and get in person and see how it works. But and I've seen this in people's stories too. The longer you prolong an online chat, and some people do for weeks and months and years, the more you're not meeting the real person.
I remember years ago interviewing an anthropologist. I think he's long since died, but he was an anthropologist here in Philadelphia, and he would go to bars and watch people and sort of see who ends up with whom. And what he found was, and he was a pretty good predictor, because when he saw that two people were in sync with each other, and by that I mean if one put their hand on their chin, the other person would do the same unconsciously, that he figured those two are going to be walking out of this bar together. And he was largely right. That always stayed with me. I thought it was so interesting.
Yeah, body language reveals a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you and talking with Daniel Jones in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about love and romance, relationships. He wrote a book called Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subject with the help of 50,000 strangers. Those strangers would be the people who write to the New York Times for essays to be selected by our guests as editor of the New York Times' very popular series, Modern Love. And there's also a podcast of Modern Love as well on WBU. You are in Boston. And to join our conversation, covering a lot of parts of love and relationships, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. This is a very obvious change in the last 12 years, but we now have legalized gay marriage. How much has that changed the kinds of essays or the column itself?
Or maybe not. It's interesting because when I first started editing this column, which is back in 2004, an essay about coming out as gay to your parents was actually a story. You know, we ran that story, and it was newsworthy in a way. That difficult kind of admission and reconciliation or not. And that quickly became not a story. So that's a sign of, I guess, social progress, but that is not a story. Then gay marriage became a story, and we ran several essays on gay marriage. And, you know, you're not going to run an essay on gay marriage anymore. It's become a settled issue, and it's not news. So in that sense, the fact that we're running this in a newspaper, there are certain stories that pass, and I feel like the column marks those changes, those social changes, as it moves forward and finds new material. And I think the transsexual and transgender experience is next on the horizon. And we're already, we've run a bunch of essays on that subject, and each change paves the way for a new change.
Which, I mean, in certain ways, that's evolution at mm-hmm. work, it seems to me. But do you find then, moving beyond, you know, gay and straight couples, as you say, we're sort of moved well beyond that, is that couples are couples and they deal with issues, however they, there aren't necessarily like gay mm-hmm. issues and straight issues.
What I find to be the issue of the day is not labeling a relationship, and not putting relationships into boxes, and this came out really. I've done three college essay contests over the 12 years, and this came out as the theme from the last college essay contest of all these students being in relationships, but not calling them anything. And this is both for good and bad, I have to say. It's not necessarily a sign of social progress. It's a sign of sort of confusion and not being sure what the next thing is. But a real aversion to saying, you're my boyfriend or you're my girlfriend or you're my lover or you're my partner. There's a confusion about terminology, and it's led to, I mean, there are a lot of sort of consequences to that. There's a benefit of people struggling to figure something out and being more accepting of different arrangements and not wanting to judge different arrangements. But it leads to consequences of if you don't call a relationship anything, if you don't call it a committed relationship, then where does it start? And if it ends, how does it end? Because you weren't committed to each other in the first place, so that it can sort of drag on. And this is all what I find people who are in college and in their 20s are mostly grappling with, is that, you know, unwilling to have their relationships fit neatly into old molds or old boxes.
Well, and it seems from some of the statistics, if we're talking about millennials, people in their, let's say, 20s, maybe early 30s, is that these people, they're marrying later. You know, they're not marrying mm-hmm. when they're 21 or 22. They're marrying when they're 30 or 32 or maybe even more than that, which I would think
right.
maybe they're more mature. They've lived a life and are more willing to know themselves, perhaps know their partner and settle down.
Right. You know, I think there's plenty of evidence that people who marry later are more likely to stay married. What's interesting to see, though, is what does that do to the real intense love relationship from people in their early 20s who think, well, this might be the person for me, but the timing is wrong. Mm. I see a sort of a lot of struggle with people thinking, well, but this, you know, this isn't when I want to get married, but this is the right person. So what do we do for the next 6 or 7 years?
You live together, don't you?
I know.
Or Living in Sin, as it was called when I was coming up. Let me get Bill from Chester to join our conversation. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty and Jack. I would just pick up on what you just said as far as, you know, people getting married older rather than younger. And I was married at a very young age. My wife was young as well. But I found myself always still seeking the greener grass, if you will. I think you were speaking about that earlier. And that helped to bring the marriage to an end. Hmm. And, you know, being someone who's had many girlfriends, and still it wasn't until I got probably into my 40s where I started to settle down a little bit and actually met through a mutual friend what I consider was my soulmate. But the timing was all wrong because I was trying to get out of a bad relationship that involved my son. There was just like, it was just totally complicated, but I knew, and not from a dating site, I was saying to your screener earlier, that I think the old-fashioned way of being introduced rather than these dating sites, because you have a mutual friend that knows each party and knows each party fairly well, and they say, hey, I got somebody I want you to meet, not just to hook up with, but I think someone that you know, as far as the third person is concerned, can connect with on a on a deeper level.
Sure, Bill. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And as I'm sure, Daniel Jones, you well know, there are many routes to finding the right person, mm-hmm. often a circuitous route to finding that right person.
Yeah, I mean, I think all options are good. And there's truth to what the caller was saying about finding someone who is in, you know, who knows you both and can set you up in that way. Believe it or not, you know, this is the direction that dating apps are moving as well, where they take advantage of people's social networks and overlapping social contacts to pick out people for you. In the same way that people used to set their friends up, now a dating app will set you up with someone in your friend group or connected to your friend group who you don't necessarily know. So it's becoming more refined and sophisticated how these algorithms do the setups of old that used to be done by people.
About a minute before our second break here, Bill used the word soulmates, and that's, you know, that's a very powerful word.
Mm-hmm.
Finding that person that you feel is the person that's been there for you from the get-go.
Yeah,
you just had to find them.
I have some trouble with the soulmate notion, but the soulmate, people think a soulmate is someone who exists out there for you and you meet them, and your purpose is to meet that person. But in my experience, a soulmate is something who is earned over decades of time. It's a person who knows you deeply on every level, and that is not someone you meet in a bar. That's someone who becomes and earns that position. So people you're really looking for someone who has the potential to be a soulmate 10 or 20 years down the road.
That's Daniel Jones, our guest. He's joining us from the Armadillo Audio Group in Pelham, Massachusetts, and he's the editor of the New York Times Modern Love series, part of Modern Love, the podcast, author of a book called Love Illuminated. And we are talking about some of the things that he has learned as the editor of the Modern Love series, and also a bit about some of his thoughts about love and relationships. 1-888-477-9499, the number to join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Daniel Jones about love. He's the editor of the New York Times Modern Love series, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. So how does someone who wrote a book called The Bastard on the Couch end up having the job that you have?
Yeah. Well, my wife is a writer named Kathy Hanauer, and this job began because she edited a book called The Bitch in the House, which was about sort of the promise of feminism that women could really do it all and have marriage and kids and a career and balance that all perfectly, and how that had fallen short and people were struggling with that. And so she edited a collection of essays that became a bestseller that was really about people grappling with that issue. And because that book was successful, it backed me into the corner of having a male response that I called The Bastard on the Couch, and that's pretty much how it went. And I had 27 men who were talking about contemporary relationships from their perspective. These books, because they were written or edited by husband and wife, got a ton of attention. And one of the people who noticed was the then style editor of the Times, a guy named Trip Gabriel. And he wanted material like that in his section on a weekly basis, and actually hired us as a couple to start Modern Love back in 2004. My wife was working on a novel at the time, and I happened to be minimally employed, so the job sort of fell into my lap. I decided to call it Modern Love, and it was a great experiment, and it just took off from there.
Was that kind of daunting in the beginning, thinking, in a sense, who am I to be able to
completely decide on
essays about people's very personal experiences and lives?
Yeah, I'm glad I was so naive in a way, because if I'd known what I was getting myself into, if I'd known how inexperienced I was, I'm not sure I would have gone ahead. But it was exciting and it was consuming, And the material, so how the column evolved actually is a bit of a surprise, because we had done our books by commissioning these stories. You reach out to writers and right. You get them to write on certain topics. And with the column, it's a very difficult process. So we thought we'd have to be doing it that way. And we ran an email address. I said, well, let's just run an email address and see what happens. My boss was a little skeptical, but he agreed, and we ran the email address, and it wasn't a month into it where there was so much material coming in just over the transom that is how the column began to be done, and that's how it's been done ever since.
Because people want to talk. They want to share information. They want to communicate about this stuff.
And it has an every man and every woman quality to it that I don't think you get if you just go out and try to find people who you know or who are in the business or who are writers. There are a lot of people who write for this column who just have good stories to tell, and yeah. I can work with them to tell that story. But that's what readers appreciate. They really want it to sound like these are people like them.
Let me get some more callers in. We've got Megan from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Megan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I guess one of the things that you were saying right before the last break, a few minutes ago, was really interesting to me. I got married when I was 31. My husband was 31. We'd known each other since high school, so 15 or 17 years. And I don't think we're going to have a problem because we were older and presumably more mature with being faithful to each other. We don't have this like urge to get attention or sow oats or anything like that. But I think the whole concept that we are more mature overall is maybe a little bit shaky for me, and I was wondering what your thoughts might be on sort of this concept of delayed maturity, because we didn't have the chance to sort of financially get on our feet, travel, live alone, do all of those kinds of things. So I almost feel like our 32 is everybody else's 22 from the 80s or 90s.
Oh, that's interesting, Megan. I appreciate the call. Daniel, anything you want to say?
Yeah, I'm not sure I've faced that question before.
Yeah.
I just think you want to be with someone who you can make decisions with. And I'm not sure what you mean, what the caller means when she says a lack of maturity or feeling like she's 22. But I think if this is someone who she has known since high school, as she said, and it's someone who she can make decisions with, I mean, I think if you go off, take trips together. Trips are always good stress tests, you know, for a relationship. Go off to Europe for a month and see how you do. If you can make those kinds of decisions together and you have a similar sense of humor and a similar aesthetic, that's the test. And if you pass it, I think you're in good shape.
I think most people in their heart of hearts feel like they're, if not immature, sort of incapable of doing what is expected in a relationship, even if they try really hard.
Yeah, I think people weigh down marriage with all these expectations. And we have this idea that we have to be good at all of it. You know, there's so many roles we have to fulfill these days. And roles used to be more divided. And now we really have to be good in every direction. As parents, you know, the pressure on people to be good parents and what that means, I don't think previous generations felt that kind of pressure in the same way that we do. So it's a lot. And I just think you have to give yourself a break. Everybody's fumbling in the dark to some extent. And I think that's one thing that comes through in this column. You know, people are definitely fumbling in the dark with these issues.
And again, Daniel Jones, our guest on Radio Times, talking about some of what has been sent to him as an essay to the New York Times popular series called Modern Love. He's the editor of the series and also wrote a book called Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subject with the help of 50,000 strangers. And springtime always feels like a kind of love time, and that's why we're having this conversation. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Megan talked about the fact that she felt that her now husband, since they've been together so long and they're in their early 30s, that they won't have to deal with things like affairs and all of that. How much do people write about the affairs that they have had or the affairs that they might be considering?
A lot. That is one of the most common stresses in
in
marriage. And I don't, you know, from what I see, it doesn't quite go away until you're, you know, maybe it, during your 50s that starts to fade a little bit. But and I have to say that technology has made that, has exacerbated that, in the sense that you, you know, how many times have I read the finding the old high school or college flame on Facebook story? It didn't used to be easy to get in touch with people like that. You'd have to call them on the phone or go to their house, and you know, people didn't do that. Yeah, and now you just exposed yourself. You know, it was just sort of a very awkward way to get back in touch with someone from your past. And now that temptation is there 24 hours a day, and people are taking full advantage, you know, whether they're at work or late at night in their bedrooms and chatting with exes and fantasizing that with that person, everything would be good. With that person, everything would be sexy. And boy, those fantasies are powerful. That person, the caller before, mentioned the grass is greener.
Yeah.
The grass is greener fantasy. If only I had married X, then all would be great. And so those are temptations that people find hard to resist. It's just sort of a constant test.
Let me see what Greta from King of Prussia has to say. Greta, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks
how are you?
So much for the show.
You're welcome.
So I just wanted to say how much I love Modern Love. I just discovered podcasts, and I've been listening to them at work. I think the first one that I heard was something about a millennial falling in love on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally was crying at work through another podcast that was talking about an adopted child relationship. They are just the most fantastic podcast I've ever heard. So
I just wanted to say
thank you so much for bringing them to us and giving people an opportunity to talk about these feelings they carry around with them and never really talk about. And they really span all kinds of different people and different stages of life. It's just fantastic. I love it.
Well, Greta, I'm sure Daniel Jones is just grinning from ear to ear.
Yeah, your check will be in the mail for that statement.
No, Greta.
It's real. It is really great. If people want to check it out, go to Modern Love, the podcast. Start there.
There you go.
If you want to read and you're at work, and cry through work with me.
Nothing like crying at work. Greta, I appreciate the call to Radio Time. And I was kidding there, Daniel, but I mean, that must feel good.
No, it feels really good. The podcast has been such a fun experience and a real surprise to me. I guess it started as sort of a humble project and became more and more ambitious. And we have actors, you know, people like Jason Alexander and Sarah Paulson and Emmy Rossum and Colin Farrell have all stepped up to read these essays. And it's funny the caller would say that she cries because that's what seems to happen over and over. To hear these trained actors read these stories and have them have, you know, sort of subtle music in the background that really heighten the emotion of the story, you know, I find myself crying too. And I've read these things 20 times and listened to them 20 times. There's something that just packs such an emotional punch. And we joke, we on the podcast team, both at WBUR and the New York Times, we joke about the kinds of tweets we see people tweeting about the podcast, because everyone is crying on public transportation. they're all listening to these things on the subway or on the bus or in their car, and they all get to work with their mascara smeared.
And that's a good day for you, right, Daniel Jones?
I guess that's a good day for us, yeah. But we've really enjoyed the project. It's been great.
Let me see what I'm probably going to mispronounce your name. Jashari from Delaware has to say. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times. Hi there.
Hi, I'm Jayshree. I'm calling from Delaware. I really appreciate the Modern Love section of the New York Times and really enjoy reading it. I just wanted to share, I'm of Indian descent, and my parents took a very active role initially in having me meet people. And if you saw the movie Meet the Patels, my life was very much like that 15 years ago. Ultimately, I met my husband, who's also Indian, on an Indian website. I joined IndianMarriages.com. He was looking on IndianDating.com, not realizing that these websites overlap.
Oh, that's great.
We met 2 weeks after we met online and had some very serious conversations within the first 3 months of meeting, we were in our early 30s, and I just think that honesty about knowing what we want and whether we're willing to sacrifice where we're moving to and when we anticipate having kids and what it would be like when our parents get old, we had these very honest conversations up front, and I really think that that benefited us in knowing what we wanted and whether we were right for each other. And I think a lot of times people avoid those conversations because they're uncomfortable, but you know, I felt lucky enough to meet someone that was very comfortable to have those conversations with.
Oh, that's great. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Daniel, anything you want to say back to our caller?
Yeah, I think she hits the nail on the head with that. The Times, I think they've done this every year the past few years, publishes a list of questions to ask a future spouse. And they're really probing questions. And it's true that people, when you're infatuated, you just think it's always going to be that the infatuation is always going to be there, and that's what's going to get you through any tough times. But God, the number of people who get married who haven't actually discussed whether they each want to have children, and that becomes a surprise after they're married that one wants children and the other doesn't. You know, those are tough conversations to have after you're married. So, get it all out on the table and find someone who's not afraid to discuss those things in advance. And it's not that you have to have the answers all in advance. It's hard to predict your life and how things might change, but have those tough conversations and see what comes out of them.
Are you talking about a Dr. Aaron? There was an essay about these 36 questions that he says couples should ask each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the most popular popular modern love column we've ever run. I think it was read by more than 10 or 15 million people worldwide. And, it was called To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. And it was written by a woman named Mandy Len Catron, who had read about this study by Arthur Aaron, that if you ask someone who's a stranger these specific 36 questions over, I think it was a 1 hour or 2 hour period, and then stared into each other's eyes for 4 minutes, which is a really long time to stare into someone's eyes, that you increase your chances of falling in love dramatically. Well, and she did that. And she fell in love, and she is still with the person. So it made a very tidy, interesting essay. But it really, sort of set off this social wave of people worldwide asking each other those questions and then hoping to fall in love. Several people did documentaries about it where they filmed people doing that. And it's really just questions about getting to know someone on a deep level and having that back and forth be equal.
Well, and we're almost out of time here. A couple of those questions. Would you like to be famous? In what way? When did you last sing to yourself, to someone else? Just a kind of sampling of these 36 questions, I guess. Well, Daniel Jones, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And again, he's editor of the New York Times Modern Love series, also part of Modern Love, the podcast, and wrote a book called Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us.